This is an ABC podcast.
I won't see the benefits of the trees I'm planting now, but Xanthia's generation will see it. I think each generation should leave something for the next, and I think that's one thing that we've done.
Shortly, we head to northern New South Wales, where a multi-generational tree planting is binding together the environment and farming, and birds and insect numbers are building. And we meet the sculpture artist who only planned to live in the small town of Woodner for a year while he created a 70-ton stone farmer statue for the town. Years later, he still works and lives there on the $1 block that he bought.
For me as an artist was a big honour. You know, people trusted me. And now today it's Woodner community custodian of a piece of art for history to remember.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. We start tonight in the far north of Queensland in a landmark class action. First Nations leaders from two remote islands in the Torres Strait are taking the federal government to court in an effort to stop the loss of their communities from climate change. Kirsty Wellauer has the story.
Global warming is lapping at the doorstep of Australia's northernmost islands of Saibai and Boigu near Papua New Guinea. As sea levels rise, Torres Strait Islanders Paul Kabai and Pabai Pabai fear for their communities and what it means for their connection to their land. Mr. Kabai says he's worried future generations will be forced off the islands and become Australia's first climate refugees.
Maybe one day we'll be underwater. So that's the main concern for us, main worry. Yeah, we're thinking like maybe 100 years down my next generation or generation to come, they probably going to be relocated from here. We want government to listen to us. We don't want to lose our island, our culture, our identity.
The men are now leading a landmark class action against the federal government, supported by the public interest advocacy group, the Grata Fund, legal firm Fee Finney McDonald, and the Dutch NGO Agenda. Grata Fund Executive Director Isabel Reinecke says the case will argue the Commonwealth has a legal responsibility to prevent the climate crisis.
What they're suggesting is that the government has failed negligently to reduce the harm that they're experiencing due to its approach of climate change. It's a complicated case, it's a big case, but it's worth a shot because its impact is undeniable. And we also know that if we don't do anything, the Torres Strait Islands are going to disappear forever.
If global temperature rise soars beyond 1.4 degrees, scientists say the Torres Strait Islands will be in grave danger. Australian National University Emeritus Professor Will Steffen says reducing emissions is essential to ensuring the survival of the Torres Strait Islands, its people and culture. He says the Australian government needs to do more.
If we can achieve net zero globally before 2050, and if we can reduce our emissions globally at least by 50% by 2030, we have a good chance to keep temperature rise to close to 1.5. And that will mean a very different future for the Torres Strait Islands in the second half of the century. But if we don't get our emissions down rapidly by mid-century, then it's a pretty horrific future for Torres Strait Islanders with increasing rate of sea level rise, much higher storm surges, more inundation, more coastal erosion. We simply have to avoid that.
The case has been filed at the federal court and is the first of its kind in Australia. It's modelled on the world's most successful climate litigation in the Netherlands, which found the Dutch government had a human rights obligation to cut emissions. London-based international climate change lawyer Tessa Kahn was involved in the case against the Dutch government and said it had been transformative.
The Dutch government's shut down coal-fired power plants. It slashed the country's emissions at a national level by a significant amount. It's invested billions of euro in a range of other carbon-cutting measures, and it's completely transformed the way that people talk about climate change in the country.
Principal lawyer on the Australian case, Brett Spiegel, says he hopes they will have a similar successful outcome.
We've been developing this case over a course of years with Agenda and with the Grata Fund, and it's taken that much time to pull together the science and the law to be able to put together a vehicle which should be able to advance the law to protect Torres Strait Islanders. And a victory for Torres Strait Islanders would be a victory for all Australians.
While global leaders prepare to meet in Scotland to commit to climate action, Mr. Kabai says their plight needs urgent attention to ensure the survival of future generations.
This is also like another step for us because we got this water level rising. all these things happening to us. And otherwise, we'll be refugees on our own land. We'll have nothing. We're not going to survive if the government not going to help us.
That's Torres Strait Islander Paul Cubbi ending that story from Kirsty Wellauer. And the ABC contacted Minister for Energy and Emissions Reduction Angus Taylor and Minister for Indigenous Australians Ken White for comment. They both replied that they can't comment on matters before the court.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
To southern Queensland now, where a once bustling town that dug its fortunes in coal is in the grip of an economic slump, but hopes a housing boom will resurrect its future. The town of Oakey, about 150 kilometres west of Brisbane, is experiencing an extreme economic downturn as a legal battle plays out that will force the nearby New Ackland coal mine into caretaker mode at the end of next month. The loss of the mine's workers is having a huge flow-on effect for small local businesses. Toowoomba reporter Georgie Hewson has the story.
Once bustling with shops and shoppers, Oakey's main street is now a ghost town.
Slowly, 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 the town's just dying slowly. And, you don't have foot traffic walking the streets like there used to be. You know, it's just got really hard.
Businesses blame the imminent closure of the nearby New Ackland coal mine. The mine's owner, New Hope Group, has waited 14 years for approvals for its Stage 3 project, but the expansion has been tied up in what's considered the state's longest-running mine dispute. With current reserves running out, New Hope has been letting workers go. The local butcher, Tony James, has seen 60% decline in sales in just 1 year.
Since they've started to close it down, it's just affected it more and more. Every time they have more people leave, it just affects the town more and more.
He says two banks and two pubs have closed in the past 2 years, and he worries his own business of 27 years won't survive.
The more families that lose their jobs at different places, the more people that move away. And so it gets harder and harder to go and you can't run around everywhere trying to find clients, so... Well, I think everybody in town would be struggling at the moment. And the ones you talk to are struggling. You know, the whole main street's a bit of a struggle.
Chamber of Commerce member and electronic store owner Andrew Langton says COVID has masked the effects of the closure of the mine for him.
We've sort of been very lucky with the fact that people haven't been able to travel, so they probably put their money into renovations and things like that for their own homes.
But says the hospitality sector has been hit the hardest so far.
It does vary probably from business to business and that type of stuff. I think it just depends on the industry you're in and that type of thing at the moment.
But there's hope the downturn could be short-lived. Local real estate agent Jeff Byers predicts a housing boom across the Darling Downs could be just what Oakey needs to get the town's economy back on track when the mine closes.
At the moment, the market is very, very buoyant, very good. We're seeing plenty of people coming to the Oakey area, plenty of people wanting to come and invest and live here.
He's sold about 40 houses in just 6 months, and those houses are spending an average of just 2 weeks on the market. He puts it down to new industries and projects slated for the area.
We're sitting on the doorstep of the Charlton Wellcamp industrial activities and Oakey itself with the abattoirs and stock feed plants, Army Aviation.
It's hoped there'll be enough to turn the town's economy around.
We've been very lucky to have a lot of new people sort of coming to the actual town itself, and it's actually helped in giving the Oakey a bit of lease of life in that sort of circumstance, but it's still probably not going to replace everything that's happened with the coal mine out there.
That's Oakey Chamber of Commerce member and business owner Andrew Langton ending that story from Georgie Hewson.
ABC Australia Wide.
The pilot will dump fuel and then light the afterburners, and it just shoots out a massive flame of lit up jet fuel. Yeah, it's a party trick.
On ABC Radio.
Yes, right now you are listening to Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. In the northwest of New South Wales, multi-generational tree planting is binding together the environment and farming. It was during the 1960s when Robin Watson came to settle on a farm in the Boggabri district and saw years of flooding eroding riverbanks. Since planting that very first tree all those decades ago, Robin has seen biodiversity grow alongside grain crops, as she told Lara Webster.
I started planting trees and grasses down over the side of the banks to try and give the banks a bit of stability. And over the years, that grew up and the banks became quite stable. And so then we planted trees in rows along the top of the banks on our side, fenced it off so that no stock could get onto the banks or around the little trees. And that gave great stability to the banks. And then we started to find that it was bringing lots of birds and animals, insects, to that area. Then later on, when we started growing cotton, we started planting lots more trees around fields to stop what was the so-called drift on the cotton. And that then, in later years, we've been joining up those patches of vegetation so that now we've got long linkages of trees, rows of trees and grassland around our fields up to remnant vegetation around the farms. And we've found that it's given us a great biodiversity across our fields. And I notice the birds and that come back round, even around our house, is just amazing.
And since those decades ago, when Robin first began her biodiversity project, her family are now all pitching in, including daughter-in-law Heike Watson, who's been planting trees ever since she arrived at the farm.
I've probably been planting trees ever since I turned up here, occasionally, because that's just what we do here.
And so when did you turn up here?
About 16 years ago. I'm a ring in from Germany.
That's a lot of trees in 16 years. You must have gotten really good.
Well, I think I can plant a tree or two all right now, yeah. Been taught well.
Tell me, as you mentioned there, you have been helping to plant trees over those 16 years. What was it like for you when you came here those 16 years ago to now, and how, as we've heard, things have changed here?
I guess planting trees really has grown in me big time, just because I've learned how amazing they are, not only just to give us oxygen, I guess, but just to see and to hear and learn how they have been helping with very different things over the years, and as they have learned. And I guess the Watson family has always been very encouraging and inviting to universities to do a lot of different research here on this farm. And just I see the value of evolving and learning from those things, and to just try and put it into practice. That's been a great thing to see.
What have the benefits been when it comes to your farm here, which is, you know, a cropping operation?
It does help us being better farmers, not because it makes us smarter. It's just amazing to see the wildlife that gets attracted into those areas, which helps us to fight our insects, our pest insects in the crops, which is a huge help. Helps us to cut down our insecticide sprays and other sprays immensely. That's been one of the biggest outcomes, and why we're keen to continue to do what we're doing, because we see that it helps us to be environmentally friendly.
Heike's 9-year-old daughter, Xanthia, has also been one of the very important planters.
How many trees do you reckon you might have planted in your career so far?
Oh, a hard question.
It's a big question.
quite a few.
Quite lots.
Yeah.
Probably. Lots. Do you like planting these trees?
Some days it's all right, but other days, like, it's just too hot and bothering.
Just rather do something in the cool somewhere.
Yeah.
What are you learning when you plant the trees?
Well, I've learned that once the tree grows up, their roots are going to stop the riverbank from erosion. They're going to prevent it from erosion. And that if once they grow up and their leaves, like, spread, the leaves are going to shade over the river, and that's going to make it cooler. Therefore, it's going to make native fishies live longer.
We were talking, Xanthia, about friends coming out and being able to help, and especially, you know, this year as well. Tell me, how fun is it to have your friends here helping?
Well, with our friends out here, it just makes it a lot more entertaining because you have someone to talk with, someone to play with, and just you just don't get so bored.
For Robin Watson, it means a lot to see her family carrying on her work.
I think it's wonderful to think that each generation now on our farm has seen the benefits of what we started. I always say I won't see the benefits of the trees I'm planting now, but Xanthia's generation will see it because they'll be big trees when she grows up, and it'll be of use to her generation. So I think each generation should leave something for the next, and I think that's one thing that we've done.
That's Northwest New South Wales farmer Robin Watson speaking to our reporter Lara Webster about multi-generational tree planting on their Boggabri farms. And from family trees in New South Wales to redwoods in Tasmania. You would usually place these giant trees in somewhere like California, but for the past four decades, Graham Freeman has been growing redwoods on his beef farm in Tasmania's northwest. It's a project that saw him declared the state's tree grower of the year. Reporter Lachlan Bennett headed out to have a look.
It started originally as a shelter belt for the cattle and to stabilise this steep bank. And that was the main reason I started off planting them.
There's plenty of shelter belts around on Tasmanian farms. Not many of them are made from an iconic tree like the redwood.
No, that's probably true. But I was interested in redwoods, and I was just lucky that at the time when I was planning to do it, the Perth nursery was selling a heap of cheap seedlings, so it seemed opportune to grab hold of them and stick them in.
And about 40 years down the track, they've all grown up big and strong, and you've actually been milling a few of them.
Yes, we've been milling, probably thinning them out by about a quarter or a fraction more, and milling the timber and selling it, so it's been very satisfactory to do that.
And what's the wood like?
It's extremely light once it's dry, durable, it's relatively fireproof. It ranges from light pink to sort of darkish orange, very attractive timber. Yeah, I like it.
Tasmania certainly has a lot of specialty timbers, and this is a specialty of the specialty, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's not really uniquely Tasmanian, obviously, but yes, there's only one other very small plantation in Tasmania that I know of, so it's relatively unique. Yes, I'm pleased I've got it. Yeah.
You've thinned it out a little bit. Are you replanting?
No, I don't have to replant these because they regrow from the stumps, so it's like a forest in perpetuity, nearly. Every time you cut it down, they just resprout and you can grow it again. So I plan to plant another area later on, hopefully, that we'll take some radiata off with it. But here, no, don't have to worry.
And when you get any visitors to the farm, what do they say when they see this this belt?
Oh, well, all the feedback I've had has been really positive, and people, doesn't look quite so cathedral-like at the moment because I've thinned it out and there's not total cover, but I think it makes people feel really nice when they walk in amongst it.
Most people would associate the redwoods with California. Tasmania is not exactly similar to that sort of place in terms of climate, in terms of culture.
No, probably not, but where they grow there in the fog belt, relatively close to the coast, obviously need reasonable amount of moisture and reasonable soils, and we're certainly getting plenty of moisture here and the soils aren't bad, so I just thought they might do all right. Never knew they would, but they've exceeded my expectations completely. Yeah.
Well, they're huge. I mean, they're standing nice and high, and knowing redwoods, if you left them here for another few decades, they'd probably just keep growing.
I'm sure they'd keep growing. I don't know whether they'd ever achieve the heights of California, but, yeah, they're only babies, complete babies, yeah.
And as far as being a shelter belt, how have they performed that job well?
Yes, they've performed it exceptionally well. You can even see along the edge here where the cattle come when it's wet. You get that first 10 feet or so, gets a bit churned up when it's windy and cold, and when it's bad weather, they just love it.
Now, you were recently named Tasmania's Tree Grower of the Year. What was it like to win that honour?
Yes, it was very special. Never expected to do that, but yes, just a very nice recognition that some people obviously think you've done something reasonably well.
Well, I guess we'd call you a redwood pioneer.
Well, yes, possibly. Not for me to say, but yeah.
So there's not too many farmers coming and asking, hey, maybe I should put them on my property?
Well, we've had some field days here and a lot of people are really interested and some people have thought about it, but whether anybody's made the leap yet, I'm not sure. But I hope some do, because I think it's proven that they will work in the right conditions.
That's Redwood Grower and Tasmanian Tree Farmer of the Year, Graham Freeman, speaking there to our reporter Lachlan Bennett.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And finally tonight, we go from wood to stone. Sydney sculpture artist, Croatian-born Marian Bekic, came to the Eyre Peninsula town of Woodina for a year to create a 70-tonne, 8-metre-high stone farmer for the community. And just like artist Goodson Borglum, who created the USA's famous and giant Mount Rushmore president sculpture, Marian set up his studio near his greatest art piece after the local council sold him a house block for $1. All these years later, he still works and lives in Woodina after falling in love with the local pink granite. Port Lincoln reporter Jodie Hamilton headed out to his studio.
The whole community helped. For me as an artist was a big honour. You know, people trusted me. And now today it's a Woodna community custodian of a piece of art for history to remember.
It's 12 years since the sculpture opened. And Marian Bekic is still in Woodna after buying a block of land for $1 from the council. Former Mayor Tim Scholes explains.
In the early 1980s, I travelled in America and visited Mount Rushmore, where the famous four presidents are. And I noted at that time that the sculptor, Borglum, actually built his work studio down the valley. So he looked up towards the sculpture of the four presidents. And since that time, that studio has become part of the narrative of the Mount Rushmore monument. And so when Marian visited, and then we developed the concept of the sculpture in the early 90s, and then later it made sense that the community offered Marian an opportunity to build a house. So he was a recipient of a dollar block, and since then he's slowly over time been building his own home here. And of course that's a very much his sculptor's home, and it has a whole lot of, will have a whole lot of detail that only a sculptor such as Marian can do. And it's pretty obvious that that house is becoming part of the narrative of the Australian farmer. And so he is noticing, and we're noticing, that, and people are asking, so there are drive-bys of tourists that come through that not only see the sculpture, but drive past where the sculpture currently lives and where he's currently working. We also see that narrative extending to our cemetery, where there are now a growing number of headstones of people who have departed this community that Marian's work commemorates their life.
What is the significance of having a sculptor of, I guess, Marian's capabilities living in Woodna?
Well, it's incredibly unique for a town of our size. And given that Marian's a long way from his homeland in Croatia and his family in Sydney, so he splits his time between Sydney and Woodna. Not only did we get the sculpture in perpetuity, but we've had the sculptor here not for the whole 30 years, but certainly for the last 18 years. Or so years.
It's a great community, I must say, you know. And then council gave me a block of land for a dollar, and you know, here I am still. And my wife is not too happy, but sometimes she comes over, and sometimes I go to Sydney. Ended up building this house, and also another aspect of or reason that I'm still here. I got this beautiful big workshop, enough space to do some of work, you know. Quarry next door, you know. I can pick up the stone. I'm basically, you know. Okay.
Is it a hard job working in stone? Like, it's not an easy material.
Of course, it is actually not easy work. It's you have to learn along the way working with stone. You have to learn to be patient and to endure, you know, to finish product. So you learn actually to be patient, lots of patience.
Is it one of those old trades that people of the house lost?
Probably in Australia, never actually got off the ground. You know, when I came to Australia, I saw this as opportunity, like a pioneer opportunity, you know. I felt that it's more like Americanized art here in Australia, more than Europeanized. In a stone monumental industry, you got more or less like Italian fashion. And I came with some skills, you know, so I could actually design something unique and individually to the person needed, you know. I had to do headstones also for to pay the bills, and what can you do? You know, lots of artists in the history, you know, sculptors, they did the headstones too, you know. It's very hard to actually live from art itself. To be honest, you know, I'm shocked that this industry, especially monumental maison industry, is actually dying. All the monumental maisons basically importing from China these days, half, you know, finished headstones and just put the inscription and that's it. But I don't do that. You know, I still live in Stone Age.
That's artist Marianne Bekic ending that story from Jody Hamilton. And that's Australia Wide for this Wednesday. Thanks for joining me this evening. I'll be back again tomorrow. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a great evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.